Today, we've got a guest helping us really understand 20% of the population who are highly sensitive people. So we're looking forward to what we need to know as coaches to support them. Deborah, tell us about Dr. Elaine Aaron.
When I first thought about this series, Dr. Aaron was at the top of my list of speakers. And I'm particularly grateful that she's joined us today, since she's at a stage in her career where she's picking and choosing her engagements. So having said that, I can't say that I was excited to find out I was highly sensitive myself. It felt more like a booby prize than anything, to be honest. But over the years, I've come to appreciate both knowing about and having this trait, mostly through sharing the information I have about it with my colleagues and clients and friends. And since roughly 1 in 5 people share it, I'm just so thrilled that we have Dr. Aaron to talk to us today about things that you may or may not be aware of in the people around you. So welcome, Dr. Elaine Aaron. I know she, yep, there she is.
There she is.
Well, thank you for that introduction. I feel very, close to Deborah. It seems like we met so long ago. I think it was in Austin. And I just remember walking from one place to another and having a lovely conversation with you that I never forgot. And then somehow we connected now and then after over those years. And one reason why I like to talk to coaches, it's like for me talking to therapists, I know that the impact I have on them spreads. So, and I'm glad that a goodly number are here, because I think this is such an important topic and it's still not known by most people. And Deborah, the research now suggests it might be closer to 30%. So I just want to define the trait, and then I'm not sure who's going to ask me questions, but whoever does is fine. Sensitivity, I define now by 4 letters plus 2. Sensitive people, we know, and we know this from a lot of research, we know that this is innate. The meaning of sensitive has a lot of meaning, and we're talking about specifically something that is innate and has 4 qualities, we say. One is depth of processing. So we use the letters DOES. Depth of processing is the most important and the least obvious, but you'll notice it in deep thinking about something, the kinds of comments you get. It's a little hard to sort out from intelligence, but even children show this. Well, why? And the whys are deeper and more concerned usually. There's and also troublemaking decisions, which you may notice more in your sensitive clients, because as they ponder everything, they see more possibilities, which is great. But at some point they have to make a decision. The second aspect, is the one that everybody notices, and it is the only liability with this trait, and that is being easily overstimulated. And sensitive people just get, because they're processing so much, they get so much in, and then their neurotransmitters wear out. It's as simple as that. And I certainly experience that when I do public speaking. But it's all around us, stimulation. And so sensitive people have to learn how to manage that. We can't expect the world to become less stimulated, although we can certainly choose our environments. DOE stands for emotional responsiveness, and also for a lot of empathy in social situations, which is another form of emotional responsiveness. And that trait enhances the depth of processing, because we never think about things for long that we don't care about. So you can see how they're linked. It's not just a problem of being emotional. And it motivates sensitive people to think more deeply about things because they're more concerned. This can backfire a bit with negative feedback, which we'll get to, because if they're paying attention to the feedback they're getting and processing it deeply, they're going to be more affected by it, which means that, just say it simply, that positive feedback is good for them, so they know what they should be doing. And negative feedback, too much of it is overstimulating and they don't hear anymore because they're trying to process it too thoroughly. The last letter is S for sensitive to subtle stimuli, which is a wonderful augmentation of the empathy because they're sensitive to what's going on with people as well as the rest of their environment. And they're sensitive to the kinds of environments that they create for people, like lighting and all of that. And they're just sensitive to those subtle things. They're sensitive to overwhelming things, but also to subtle things. The other two letters is differential susceptibility, which is extremely important. We have found out that sensitive people are more vulnerable, especially in childhood, to negative experiences, but they're also more sensitive, susceptible to positive experiences, especially in childhood, but throughout their life. So if they're in a positive environment, they just thrive. Put them in a negative one, and they wilt. So one of the things about this is that society sees mostly the poorer functioning people who had a really troubled childhood usually and have more depression, more anxiety, more shyness. And then the others that I call, I dread using this word, but I can't think of another good one, high functioning HSPs, are invisible in terms of their sensitivity. They just people like them because they're so sensitive, because the word has this positive and negative connotation, you may notice, because they are good morale builders, because they have great creative ideas, and just quite marvelous. And the fact they need downtime looks kind of like, oh, she likes her solitude, you know, it's kind of like a lovely trait, because they usually have pretty good control over the overstimulation aspect. They know when they've had it and they back off. So that's the basic trait. I'd like to point out that this might, being a minority, is not because it's so hard on them, or, you know, evolution said, well, let's not make too many of those people because they don't survive very well. On the contrary, there's no advantage for, and this trait is found in over 100 other species, there's no advantage to being sensitive to your environment if everybody's sensitive to your environment. I make the analogies that our smartphones have kind of ruined this analogy, but if you know a shortcut that nobody else knows, it's only a shortcut as long as nobody else knows it. So sensitive people have an advantage of their being sensitive, just by the very fact that not everybody is. So that's kind of my most important stuff. Oh, 30% are extroverts, and about that percentage are also high sensation seeking, which means they might be an introvert, but they like lots going on. They get easily bored. And this sounds like a contradiction, and it is to some degree, because it's hard for people who have both traits. But the real opposite of sensitivity is impulsiveness, which you don't see much in sensitive people, and unless something else is going on from their personal history. Okay, want to fire some questions at me?
I do. Thank you so much. Thanks for really helping us understand the elements of this trait and the six letters. As a coach, how would I know, do I need to know, that I'm coaching an HSP?
Well, I think you need to know, because first of all, if they don't know they're highly sensitive, and you kind of figure that out, and there is a self-test that you can let them take, it's a huge step in convincing them that you're the right person for them. It's like it really makes a good bond. How to know? I think that, of course, you can use this self-test if you want, or you can read the self-test yourself and then begin to pick out items from that that you might be able to observe or ask about. But it is a little tricky, because there's these high functioning ones, and there's these extroverted ones, and these high sensation seeking types. So I think the most important thing probably is that they were born with the trait. And that's something you can kind of suss out with a few questions. You can point out a behavior that is typical of a sensitive person, like complaining about too much stimulation, and then ask them, is that typical of you in many different situations? I think sometimes the trait gets mixed up with things like trauma and PTSD, which is not there from birth and is triggered by certain situations, whereas sensitive people's sense of being overstimulated is triggered by all of them. The emotional responsiveness, again, is important because you may find, I heard something about a style of going deep and going quickly, that might be too much for a sensitive person. It just might be too much. I don't know what that means, but they need to assimilate what you're saying. So that's another thing you can notice, is that you may overstimulate someone. Many's the time I have gone into situations that were focused on me, like a medical situation, and I just started to cry. And it very well could happen. HSPs cry more easily. And I didn't say this, but it's very important. Sensitive men, equal numbers as sensitive women. And they hide it much, much more. So you might not spot it for quite a while. They hide their tears. They hide their emotions. And it's harder to convince them that this is a valuable asset in their lives. But they tend to be very conscientious, tend to be very focused on ethics, and just kind of highlighting things that might be obvious in the sensitive man. They tend to often be a bit angry because they feel like they've been fighting the world for a long time and having to give up a lot of themselves in order to fit in. So if there's any more questions, it's a very important question because you can't respond to it. And with men especially, you might bring it up very tangentially, as I like to do with children. Wow, you really knew what was going on in that situation, didn't you? So you bring up, if possible, the most positive quality and say, you know, that makes me think that you're very sensitive to your environment. Is this true in other situations? So gentle, because, you know, Deborah said it, she didn't feel so great when she first learned she was highly sensitive. Men especially, you know, when you're coaching them because they want to perform better and better, say that they have some defect, which is how they hear it, because that's how they've always felt. Often these are guys who fell down in kindergarten and cried and got, you know, teased mercilessly for being a crybaby and a mama's boy, and they learned to shut it up. And that's important to be aware of. And it may not be something that you want to bring up right away, even though it would be, if you're sensitive to it, you'll be able to help them without even labeling the trait for a while.
To your point, John, one of the people here, said it took him almost 60 years to come to grips with this notion of being an HSP. It was quite a revelation to him. And he also asks, and I think this is important for all of us, what are some implications for the coach if you are an HSP yourself?
A very good question.
What do you need to do from a self-management standpoint?
Well, we call it the 5 to thrive, and I think I can adapt it to coaches, but the first is really believing about your trait, which I think all of you can grasp pretty quickly if you're highly sensitive. But if you doubt, you can go to my website and look at some of the research, reviews of research, because there's over 100 good studies of it now. Then you really, if there's wounds to heal, you need to get down and do that because of this susceptibility, which we respond more to interventions. There's research on that. So we can get out of our stuck place pretty well with some good help. And then reframing our lives is very important, because this is all about self-esteem. And as a coach, you have to have confidence in yourself and dig out those places where maybe you became a coach because you recall times when you really screwed up. And those times are the ones you want to see. Why did I do that? And was it related to aspects of my sensitivity, so that you can then feel good about those and be more accepting of them and other people? Then it's good to meet some other highly sensitive people, so that again, you're confident that they exist, and I'm sure they exist among the coaches. So maybe as you connect around this, you can connect up so that you can talk with each other about how it affects your coaching. But the most important thing is you have to change your lifestyle. And this is not happy news for HSPs or for coaches. You have to cut back. You have to be at your best. You have to do less and accomplish more. Because when your consciousness is clear and you're rested, then you're so much more effective. And I'm sure you've all seen that in yourselves, because it's true for everybody. Things that are true for sensitive people are usually true for other people, that they just don't realize it. So that's a good point about coaching, is that you can use what is good for you and often overlooked by other people, that nobody does well when they're overstressed, overstimulated, over-aroused. So the importance of downtime. I recommend meditation. I specifically recommend transcendental meditation because its whole point is to relax. Within 20 minutes, you get as deep as the deepest state of sleep. You'll have thoughts, and there's no pushing away thoughts. If you get sleepy, you're supposed to just lie down and sleep. So it's not, there's no concentration or task to be done, like paying attention to something. You think the mantra, and when you're thinking about something else, fine. But now I've noticed that I'm not thinking the mantra, but you don't try to hold on to the mantra. So just to clarify that, because people often equate meditation with mindfulness now, and they're really quite different. So some kind of downtime, and without the radio or the TV, like often do your chores just without any sound, because your mind will bounce around. And it often solves a problem that you had on your mind just when you relax. We know that about creativity in general, but most people forget to take the time. I knew someone who spent a lot of time in Washington and said the thing that appalled him was that nobody took the time to think things through. They were making quick decisions. And I joke that in this culture, someone who can make a quick decision that's wrong is more valued than someone who takes time. So that's a tricky thing with coaches who, you know, you have to kind of teach them to be able to move quickly and seem decisive. But if you can put off a decision just a little while, that's often means that the brilliant one comes up. My son writes comedy in Hollywood, and he's quite successful. And he's a sensitive person and introverted. He got his job by waiting until his friends from the Harvard Lampoon got jobs and then let them hire him. And they all do comedy writing around a table, the famous table. But he thinks up all of his jokes at home because he can't think at the table very well. And so he brings them in and acts like he just thought of them. So I think you can coach people to handle performance. Performance anxiety is a huge pressure. I'm going to do a talk on performance anxiety for a university because the pianist contacted me and asked what he could do for himself and his students for their performance anxiety. And there's a lot to that, but I'm sure as a coach, you run into this a lot. And you're going to run into it more in sensitive people, but they can always get over it. Look at me. I was so terrified of public speaking. I have no thought I can speak to 1,000 people. I did it once, was sick for 3 months afterwards. So you have to be careful, but I don't get nervous anymore speaking, and because I've done it over and over. So a lot of it is familiarity. Another piece is just thinking about the people you're speaking to. Because you learn that they really want what you're telling them. And whatever you're telling them, if they don't really want it, you shouldn't be telling them that. So there's a lot of pieces to performance anxiety, but just to say that don't think that sensitive people can't do it, can't do whatever you're coaching them to do. But you do have to realize there may be a high cost to it for them. Other questions?
I'm still pondering something you said earlier, that highly sensitive persons are impulsivity is the opposite of high sensitivity. And I've seen what I would consider a lot of impulsive behavior from them. And as I'm trying to make sense of that, I would say, like in a crowd, suddenly they bolt and they have to leave, or the anger seems to pop out of nowhere, like they're calm and then suddenly boom. And it seems like, you know, low impulse control. What's your sense of that? Is it, you know, it seems like there's some kind of tipping point going on.
I think tipping point is a good way to put it, is that they're trying to adapt and they're trying to be like other people. And then at some point, because of that emotional responsiveness, they pop and they need to learn how to, you know, emotional regulation. Most of them don't, but those who do need to learn to appreciate and respect the emotional reaction they're having. I call them emotional leaders because often they feel what should be felt by everyone before other people feel it. So people in a crowd may all be getting overwhelmed, but this person walks out right away. And the emotional regulation I've written about it on my website as a blog, which, by the way, you can, there's an actual Google search on the website, and I've written about almost everything. That's a whole other subject, but yeah, emotional regulation is important. And they do know about it. They know about their emotional reactivity, and some of them don't respect it, and hence squash and then burst. I think that's too, it's a good observation. But the impulsiveness would be things that would put them in danger more. Like I know people who are hang gliders, but they're experts on the safety. I talked to a mother about a boy who loved downhill ski and was considered the best by the other kids, but he knew everything about what he was doing. He was very skilled. And I've known sensitive people who are police officers, and they're very skilled. They know when something's going down before anybody else does. They keep themselves safe. There's some there's a study of something that a gene that is thought to be related to sensitivity, that they were looking at Israeli soldiers in training and in combat as to who was likely to get PTSD. They actually found that the soldiers during training who had this gene were much more frightened. When they got into combat, they were less frightened because they had thought of all the possibilities and what they would do before they ever got there. And they're great in emergencies because that's usually true. They thought of all the possibilities and what they do. So in that sense, they've thought through things, so they're not impulsive. But in this other way, in this emotional area, I think it's something that can really be worked on and should be. Other questions?
We have quite a few things showing up in chat. And I'm just gonna pick one that really resonates with me. What's the relationship with trauma? Is there a cause and effect relationship? You know, early childhood trauma, for example?
Oh yes, I just said differential susceptibility. Early childhood trauma means you're gonna be more affected by that trauma. But to separate it from sensitivity, is that if you're talking to a person, you find out that there was an hour or a series of events that made them so sensitive to certain things, whereas these people have been sensitive all along. That's why we call it differential susceptibility, because it's not vulnerability, but one side of it is vulnerable. And even in these people who've had trauma, you usually find a lot of virtues from due to the sensitivity, and that kind of has to be plucked apart. And then the trauma part has to be worked on, and it can be. We never get rid of the effect of our traumas, but they can be transformed, I think. one of the concepts that's very important to me as a depth psychologist is the idea of a complex. These get built up, and we all have complexes, our mother complex, our money complex, our food complex. We all have energy around certain subjects, but then you can spot a complex in a person when they begin talking very forcefully in a more black and white way, and you feel like you're playing some sort of a role with them, like you've become their critical father, or you've become their audience or whatever, and you don't get a word in edgewise. And they're often around traumas. That's often how you spot them.
The other theme for me that comes from that is the potential for substance abuse as a way, you know, and I don't necessarily mean actual abuse, but using substances to numb themselves or to escape some of the sensitivity, to mask it. What do you see there?
I don't have any research on that, so I really don't know. There's one study of shy people, which I thought was very funny. It was predicted that if they went to a party, they would drink more to deal with their shyness. They actually drank less than other people because they were afraid they'd do something stupid. They were afraid about how they were going to get home. And they're just generally, I think, cautious of things like addiction because they've seen it in other people. And I like red wine for dinner, but I have a measuring cup. I pour 5 ounces. And that's all I drink because I like it a lot. And I used to just, you know, pour a little more and pour a little more during dinner. No, I'm not doing that anymore. And I never have liked to drink during the day or after dinner, but I really believe a lot in the genetic component of addiction. Do you know that this study of rats and hamsters, they put them in a social environment where they can work, they can play, they can socialize, do anything they want. And there's a bar, and it works with cocaine too. And about a third of them cannot leave that bar. About a third of them ignore it. And about a third of them go over now and then, sort of like social drinkers. I think that's interesting. And that, you know, it's just the whole issue. Some people just can't touch the stuff, you know.
There is, we talked about the fact that highly sensitive people think about things more deeply and they are working more to look ahead, see around corners, think about potential second and third order consequences, all really, really valuable traits. Is their intuition or instinct about what's going to happen in the future always correct? Or is there a place where they're also showing up as worrying about things that aren't going to happen? So is there an overreaction in there? And then what are the other social assets of this?
Carl Jung, who developed, you know, the Myers-Briggs with that particular trait of intuition, he always said that all the functions could be wrong. And intuition is one that especially people can, well, thinking probably too, not all of them sensing, you know, you think you fixed it and it's not fixed. So we definitely can make mistakes. I say intuition is knowing things without knowing how you know them, but you know them from the information you have. Therefore, if your information is wrong, your intuition is wrong. And yes, I like to joke that suppose you take an HSP to the racetrack and they're not very familiar with horse racing, and they notice in the first race the jockey wearing red won the race, and in the second race the jockey wearing red also won the race, and now this person thinks they have a method of choosing who will win, and it's wrong. So, you know, that's why it's so important for all of us to have all the information we can before we jump to conclusions. You asked another question and I forget what it was.
What are some of the other social assets of being an HSP? What are the places where you want to make sure you have and you're figuring out a diverse organization, where do you want to make sure you have HSPs? How do you want to deploy them?
I think they're often good with morale. They need to be in a place, however, where they're not overstimulated. So for instance, not an open office plan if possible. They're often good with morale. They often know what's going on. There's a lovely little article by a man named John Hughes on the leadership abilities of sensitive people. And I highly recommend it. It's in LinkedIn, but I think it's, I've reprinted it, I think. So you can find it. John Hughes, something about sensitive leaders. And he makes 4 points. I'm not sure I'll remember them all, but they're really good. They're very good running a project in which they know what's going on with their team members, and they tend to step back and let the team members gain the success because they like doing that. And it can be a flaw. I don't think they're very much into ranking. I use the term ranking and linking. They're much more into linking, and both, all humans do both things. All horses and dogs and every social animal ranks and links both. They have friends and they have leaders, and they try to keep on top. So they're not very, but everybody enjoys actually linking more than ranking. But ranking is just a necessity in our society. And I think they enjoy linking more. They do often see the right answer, but they don't always jump in, which is important. They do often hold back in meetings where they're not in charge with their right answer because it often has consequences. But I encourage them to be somewhat Machiavellian. If they're going to present an idea in a meeting and they think it might be shot down, usually what happens is somebody else didn't think of it, or they feel their idea is shot down because this person is suddenly giving a better idea or saying all the problems with the idea. So I encourage them to go to the key people in the committee or the team beforehand and get them on board before they go into a meeting and present something. So they can be Machiavellian, but you have to encourage them to be. I have a wonderful book here called, I think it's called Leading Quietly. You probably know the book. It's by a Harvard business guy. And there are stories of people, he doesn't say their ages, but there are stories of people who saw problems, usually ethical problems in their organization. And instead of plunging in and being a whistleblower, they strategized how to change things, how to get rid of the key person, not barging in, but, you know, tricky, basically. And I think that's something that sensitive people can really do if they feel ethically right about it. So it's not just morale building, it's spotting problems and solving them in a way that works best. And that's, I think, a wonderful thing to encourage as a coach in them. You know, they can, it all goes down the drain when they're overstimulated. So an important part of their social life has to be not overdoing it. And on the other hand, they've got to be out there knowing what's going on. If they're not at the lunch room, or if they're not getting some of the gossip, they're out of the loop. And that's a serious problem too. So I think if you put self-care, management of stimulation at the top, you get better results in the social life too. There's a study that a friend of mine did. She's at the University of Bamberg in their business school, which is quite renowned. And she's interested in people who are sent by businesses to other countries. And she found, unfortunately, that sensitive people were not performing as well because they were not doing enough social networking. So one has to watch what you ask of them. And they have to know when this is not a good thing for them. Too much travel, probably they can't handle it. Too much 24/7, probably they can't handle it. Other questions? I love answering questions. I have no problem with them. Is there somebody really skeptical? I'll take it on.
No skeptics so far. But curious, what's the relationship between hypervigilance as a fear-driven reaction and high sensitivity?
Oh, well, they're really quite different. The fear, the hypervigilance, you can feel the physical. I mean, you can probably as a coach even feel it. The intensity of the vigilance is being triggered by something. To some degree with trauma, you do have hypervigilance everywhere. But sensitive people, when they're not frightened, have usually a good deal of calmness because they need to reflect deeply, and they'll they'll get away sometimes to do that. It's just very different. There's actually a paper by Bianca Acevedo comparing the brains of PTSD, people with PTSD and HSPs, the brain function. Unfortunately, it wasn't a study where they could give them the same task, but she was looking at similar tasks and how the brain was behaving differently. Clearly, if you think about hypervigilance, the brain's going to be behaving differently than someone born with a sensitivity to their environment who have not had a serious trauma. It's just going to be different. Spotting it might be difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you talked about a minute ago about this notion of linking and how important that is. What are some thoughts and ideas for people who are locked down, working from home, not in a physical social environment to be able to make that linking happen? What are the survival strategies for that?
Well, you got Zoom, right? You got Skype. You have to have some physical contact. I have to tell you, people are always asking me, well, how highly sensitive people responded to the pandemic. I say, I don't know how have left-handed people respond to that pandemic. It's all depends on your circumstances. In fact, it was right at that point when I began to get tired of the whole HSP thing because I'm tired of making generalizations about them. I mean, I make a lot of them and I know they're valuable, but there are some places where it's just hard to go. I know some sensitive people who have loved the lockdown and the fact that they will never be in the office again 5 days a week. And I think that's quite a lucky break for some sensitive people. But certainly, I think of social stimulation as like food. You have to have some hearty meals, some snacks, but you don't want to stuff yourself either. And we find that all of a sudden, a lot of our friends and relatives want to Zoom with us more than we want to Zoom with them.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Yeah, so it's a matter of how full you want to get.
Well, and I think that's the issue.
What flavors you like.
Right. Can you create linking environments where you can dip in and dip out as you need to, or are you in an environment where you have to constantly be on Zoom all of the time, where that exposure and stimulation from others is just too much? You talked about best practices we can bring as coaches, managing stimulation and self-care. What would be advanced ones beyond that?
Suggestions, I didn't quite hear, beyond self-care, suggestions.
Managing stimulation and self-care was a critical one that you shared with us. Right. What are best practices we can help people with once people have those taken care of?
Well, you're still best practices around overstimulation. Is that what you're asking me? Okay. Well, I divide it into three categories. There's planning beforehand, because often you can avoid overstimulation. You know that some things are going to be that way and you choose. You can't just not do anything, but you choose. Then during, there are lots of ways to keep it less impactful. 80% of our stimulation comes in through our eyes. So just closing your eyes for 5 seconds can help. And then maybe redirecting your attention. You have to meet people's eyes at times, but also people might look down at the table or something. So during it, and also taking breaks. And when you feel you need a break, often everybody needs a break. So if you can suggest maybe it's time for 5 minutes and then don't talk during that time. If possible, go outside or go somewhere where no one will find you in order to get that little respite. Sometimes you have to talk with people, but that's not getting any downtime. Afterwards, they need to plan a little time. They need to plan, if they've been on a week-long trip, they need to have a day of nothing before they go back into the office or whatever.
Makes sense. We've talked about managing stimulation. We've talked about helping people be Machiavellian. Anything else that would be more additional strategies that coaches can help themselves and their clients?
Well, I think of balancing work and the rest of their lives. That's very hard for sensitive people because they know about other people's needs. They know what their children need. They know what their partner needs. my son with his sensitivity. I guess a lot of young people now are saying this, but I thought it was interesting. He says, there's three things in your life. There's your family, there's your work and your friends. He says, if you have little children, you just can't have friendships much. You can have them, you can acknowledge, you can touch bases, but you don't have time for them. He said, now there's a fourth one, which is self-care. And that one, they have to get their priorities. Their self-care comes first, because then that makes them able to respond to family and respond to work. But it's a stressful thing for sensitive people, stressful for everyone, but more so for them. So, and they don't want to look weak, especially the men, but the women, they see these super moms around and they just don't understand how people do it. My response to sensitive parents is always get help, spend money on help. Childcare help, house help. Art and I have an assistant. We hire a college student who does a lot of the busy work that we don't want to do, and it really helps. And I joke to sensitive parents, you don't want to spend the money now? Well, you are saving the money for your kid's college. Well, your kid may not get into much of a college if you wreck him now. I don't put it that way, but sensitive people can be the best parents or some of the worst parents, and that's clear from research.
There's another question in here about changes over time. You've mentioned that this is primarily genetic in origin, not the result of experiences, but how about as people age or mature, do people become more or less sensitive with time? Is there any research on that?
There isn't any research on it. There's just my observation that teenagers are the most fouled up. They're trying to be like everybody else. And they have more capacity genetically to handle stimulation, this listening to music while you study and stuff. Around 30, I think sensitive people begin to have trouble unless they know about their trait. And as the older people get, generally, if they're pretty high functioning HSPs to begin, they just get wiser and wiser about their sensitivity, about everything else that's going around them. But, you know, the ones with unresolved issues probably get worse, because what I noticed with my clients that I was working with before I retired was that as you age, you watch your peers being successful and you not being successful. And that is a devastating experience. You know, you can't find a good job. You can't find a good partner. You can't, you know, and sensitive people with trauma and painful past, I would guess you see a number of them come in, and it's their self-esteem is just dropping with every year. So again, it's hard to generalize. I have not written anything about sensitive people and aging, because I honestly think, you know, about the pandemic, I say we're all in the same storm, but different boats. And I think that's really true with aging. The research on that was marriage and other things, is that there's more diversity as time goes on. So we all have to be careful about who we are becoming.
I agree. That's fantastic. One question, I think Regina has asked this: what is the connection between HSP and self-awareness? Specifically, if a client can shut down when receiving hard feedback, how are they getting the important information they need to craft reality? What's the best way to communicate difficult messages to an HSP?
Well, for one thing, they'll go home and think about it. They'll be able to take it in better. So don't lose faith that you said something to them and then they just didn't get it, or they got defensive, which everybody does. But, you know, I've heard the rule and I love it. When you're saying something critical, say 5 positive things with it. They'll hear the critical, but include the positive. And sometimes a thing you have to criticize has a side of it that's an asset, but they're overdoing it. Sensitive people, I've noticed, when they get criticism from a supervisor, they overreact often. They rewrite the whole thing when there was only one paragraph that was a problem. And then they create new problems for themselves. And in coaching also, I think you can talk about how they respond to criticism and how they're responding to what you're saying. So it's kind of getting into their whole process of hearing criticism, because they have to be able to hear criticism from other people. You have to, but you have to analyze, you know, where is this coming from and how important it is relative to other things. And, you know, all kinds of things. And then I always say, as a writer, I get criticism, take 24 hours before I respond, because usually there's truth in it. My husband read a chapter of my new book, and you know, all of a sudden he said, well, you didn't. And I said, yes, I did. And then in a few hours, he's absolutely right. And that's a wonderful point he's made. So we read each other's work a lot, but you know.
That's wonderful. Such a great example. Thank you. We're nearing the end of our time with you. We as a group will continue our conversation. I think you've planted some very interesting themes that really relate to topics that we have been reviewing lately. Our position here is that we really value learning and development and self-growth. And so we always ask our guests, what's on your learning horizon? What are you currently exploring? What are you learning about? What are you doing to get better?
Well, I love to write. I love being creative in every way. I'm also have an artistic bent, but you have to choose one and really go for it. And I love having something really new to say or new to explore. So that's what your point about it. No, I could never give up being creative. I think that's definitely important.
I love that. Creativity, if you stick with it, is a great pathway to learning. So thank you so much.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure to talk with all of you. That I, the chats, I couldn't get rid of them, but I just totally ignored them. When I have done a large thing with HSPs and the chats were visible, everybody ended up overstimulated.
We have many people that we have to, who are much happier if they turn off the chat, and other people who love it. Deborah, you've graciously brought Dr. Aaron here to us. Any closing thoughts, what you learned today, what we're sharing, how you want to wrap this up?
As always, I learned something from you. And, you know, for me, when I share this information with clients so often, especially lately, people are like, oh my God, that explains so much. And that's why I thought this is going to be really important for others on the Virtuoso calls to know about. So thank you so much for coming and sharing that with us. Well, and you know, so often I see people who are making such broad generalizations about being highly sensitive that have actually nothing to do with the trait. And so I really appreciate you coming in and presenting some of the science and the specifics about it rather than some of the dramatic stuff that can sometimes.
I know, it's become a whole new fashion and source of income for many people.
Yeah. Thank you.
Terrific. Elaine, thank you so much. Many folks here have said they're going to keep your secret safe. Thanks so much for including us and sharing us in where you're heading in the future. We really appreciate taking your time to join us today. And I love this notion that if you work with coaches and therapists, you can really increase your impact. That's really what we care about here as well, and why we're so focused on having this group really grow their skills so they can make the biggest difference with their clients as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Deborah. Thank you, both Davids.
Can I just say one more thing? I don't know if you guys saw this. I posted it in chat, but she does have a process by which she will certify coaches who are highly sensitive, who want to coach specifically HSPs. And in the process, you learn an awful lot about what she's been talking about today.